Brexit. Remember that? Well, there's a trade negotiation going on with Europe, so strap in. We're about to tell you all you need to know.
We will do a new deal, a better deal, a new and exciting partnership with the rest of Europe.
You cannot have the best of both worlds.
The Brexiteers, in my opinion, they have no any clue of what needs to be done.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. In today's podcast, we return to a right-wing political project which, understandably, has not got a lot of attention of late. Brexit, of course. What's happening with that? Well, there's a trade negotiation going on with the EU, and it's not going well. Remember all that talk about a no-deal exit? Well, it didn't happen. We left with a deal. But that runs out at the end of this year. And in 2021, there's this idea, promoted by some Tories, that we would combine facing the biggest economic crisis we've ever experienced in peacetime with failing to strike a trade deal with the EU. If that sounds like a mad recipe for food shortages and the like, well, it is, of course, and it probably won't happen for precisely that reason. But as we'll hear on today's podcast, there's lots of concern that it could now happen by accident, as tensions boil over between Brexit Britain and its erstwhile EU partners. Joining us to talk about it is Laura Bannister of the Trade Justice Movement. She'll be explaining what a good EU trade deal could look like and why a bad deal or no deal at all could be a disaster for workers' rights and the environment. We're also joined by Christos Katsoulis, the director of the London office of the Friedrich Herbert Stiftung and a longtime friend of the Another Europe campaign. As usual, you can feedback to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org. You can also support the podcast by leaving a rating or review on your podcast platform. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe. To join and support our work, go to anothereurope.org/join.
The EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, says the UK has taken three steps back from its original commitments and risks a no-deal Brexit at the end of the year.
Welcome, both of you, to the show. So, Laura, maybe you can help us out with the first question. What does the British government want from these negotiations?
So the UK government wants there to be no fixed minimum standards on workers' rights or environmental protections, whereas that's something that the EU is proposing. They want to use the treaty as a way of making sure that neither side can fall below certain minimum levels on those areas. So the UK government essentially wants to make sure that we don't have any protection for our rights. And they're framing that as a way of making sure the UK is properly independent. But ultimately, the people that are going to lose out from that are workers whose rights can then be eroded, and essentially all citizens whose environment can then be depleted because we're losing that extra layer of protection that we could otherwise have.
And this is what we've been warning against for years as Remainers, but we're in this kind of almost dangerous situation in a way. Lots of people have become dangerously resigned to it happening, right? The bonfire of regulations and protections that you're describing?
Yes, in a way, although really there's pretty much no one calling for that approach. So UK business organisations like the Chambers of Commerce are coming out and saying they would rather retain some alignment or some kind of minimum standards in common with the EU because that will enable better trade and easier trade and cheaper trade. So, you know, even business groups who you think might be in favour of a bonfire of regulation aren't in favour of it. So although people are perhaps not surprised by what the government is calling for simply because, you know, of the nature of the current government, it's certainly not a position that's popular or that's really being driven by any constituency in the UK that I'm aware of.
Actually, most of the conversation at the moment is all around animal welfare. But do you see the worker element to it to be the most significant and consequential?
Workers' rights is going to be a huge issue following this. So there's a lot of rights that have been developed by the UK and the EU in partnership, but enshrined in EU law, that refer to smaller groups of workers, so part-time workers, agency workers, pregnant workers, groups that are not necessarily the majority and not always going to be able to advocate to preserve those rights if they start to get eroded over time. So yeah, workers' rights is going to be a huge issue, but there's a lot of issues in this. There's no clear sign that the NHS is going to be protected from liberalisation rules. That means rules that would protect private companies that are involved in running NHS services, for instance. And then there's, as you said, food standards issues and animal welfare standards to do with how we run our farms and produce our food that aren't going to be protected either. There's issues like air pollution and water pollution, which traditionally the UK has needed quite a lot of pressure from the EU to take action on some of those areas, air pollution in particular. And we know that's a huge killer in the UK. So this is a real issue, especially for people on lower incomes who tend to suffer from those issues more. And yet the UK government is refusing to accept any minimum standards in these areas. So I think it's hard to pick out just one area that's the key issue, because it's really going to touch us in a lot of ways.
So Christos, to bring you in at this stage, could we talk a bit about how the British position has been received at the EU end? We've had a series of press conferences that Michel Barnier has given, which is fair to say that the frustration that has been accumulating with the British government for many years since 2016 is continuing amongst the remaining EU states. They don't like the look of this British deal at all, do they?
No, absolutely not. And I think frustration is one word to describe what's going on in Brussels. The other words I would use is suspicion and mistrust, and also kind of bewilderment, because what the British government seems to be trying to get in Brussels is described as Canadian alignment. And that's, according to what Laura just said, no standards upholding at all, but Swiss access. So whatever cherries there are in the European Union, the UK government seems to be wanting them. And when we talk about the standards in environment, in workers' protection, air pollution, and so on and so forth, the funny thing here is that the EU, that has been cutting down barriers all over the world and hasn't been the good guy in trade relations, now for the first time seems like the really good part in these negotiations, because the UK government is in such a different and, from my point of view, difficult position.
So what is the impact of coronavirus on these talks?
From a European perspective, it's just that nobody cares for Brexit for the past 4 months. I don't think any European leader has spared one thought since the 31st of January on Brexit. So there's no political bandwidth at the moment to deal with the British government and its kind of excessive ideas about the future relationship. And therefore, time is becoming an issue, because we're approaching very fast this point where we could ask for a transition. Otherwise, we have to have a deal until the end of the year. So Corona has just squeezed the time we already had, which was very short, to an even more shorter period.
And Laura, we've also had at one point in these negotiations, the European Parliament, I think the European People's Party, said, for goodness sake, to our centre-right erstwhile allies in the UK government, okay, they weren't in the same group towards the end, but nonetheless, they're from the same tradition, just extend the transitional period. There's the biggest crisis facing Europe and the world in probably a century. Just extend the transitional period. And the British government turned around and were completely dogmatic about it. It just seems like a mad reaction to the circumstances that Britain and the world is facing.
Pretty much every group on every side of this issue seems to be wanting an extension to transition. The UK public want it, or the majority do. You know, businesses want it, civil society groups and campaigns and trade unions want it, the European Parliament wants it. It is baffling that the UK government is insisting on pressing ahead with trade negotiations in which they seem completely unwilling to give an inch. They're really holding out on some quite extreme positions. And then now they're doing that at the expense of, you know, government time and attention, public time and attention that should be devoted to dealing with the pandemic. The other issue is that we're potentially then going to face a no-deal Brexit at a time when we're still reeling from the coronavirus pandemic. So, you know, in January, we're potentially going to be leaving the EU with no trade deal, as it looks at the moment, because there's really, you know, so little movement from really either side. And that means that's going to bring huge economic disruption. It always would have done. But adding that economic disruption on top of the highest unemployment rates we've seen in nearly a century, on top of, you know, huge negative growth in the economy, on top of massive change that businesses and individuals have already had to take on board, to then lump on top of that, suddenly dealing with, you know, EU tariffs, dealing with all the regulatory barriers that are going to fly up inevitably between the EU and the UK that are going to affect supply chains. And ultimately, this has an impact on people's jobs, and it has an impact on how things are done in so many areas. So it's just a level of disruption that we really can't handle, and yet they seem determined to bring to us at this time.
Can I just get both your views on a strategic point? A lot of people were saying today that the Conservatives are so baked into their position that the only way they're going to change it is if they get to the change themselves, i.e. opposition parties shouldn't be pushing for a transition because they'll just dig in. Does that ring any bells with you, or do you think something different?
We always needed an extension to the transition period. It was never really long enough to negotiate a proper trade deal. That was clear from the beginning before the pandemic came along. And the pandemic, in a way, would have been the perfect excuse for them to quietly acknowledge that and ask for a transition while saving face. And so I think if they didn't take that opportunity, I very much doubt they're going to suddenly do it just because everybody else is staying quiet and not calling for it. I think it seems that they are doggedly committed to completing Brexit at the end of this year, regardless of the consequences for people everywhere.
It's even more cynical. Some people in Brussels talked about these issues, and there was even thoughts about a very cynical maneuver of the Conservatives, meaning that the huge impact of the corona crisis could kind of hide the impact of a no-deal Brexit. So it would be kind of a blip in whatever deep recession we were having. So they could drive their agenda of Brexit home. And that's absolutely possible, I think, yes.
And I know that lots of people on the European side are very much saying this. I still have the view that we have a sort of model already of what the UK government does towards the end of these ticking timelines. And that was the 11th hour deal that was struck as a result of the agreement special status for Ireland that got us the withdrawal agreement eventually, and then of course allowed Boris Johnson to stand in the general election on the platform "Get Brexit Done."
We are a party that is going to get Brexit done by January the 31st, and we've got a deal that's ready to go.
An infinitely stronger slogan politically than no deal Brexit if you vote for me, right? So I still think at the 11th hour, because they know that taking this sledgehammer to the economy that no trade deal exit in January next year would look like, I still believe that what they'll end up doing, the outlines of a deal potentially would be staying in the single market for goods, which I think the European side would accept, while leaving the freedom of movement system for Labour. And that kind of not changing very much, but changing one thing, immigration, hot political topic, a tangible success of Brexit as Johnson and others would present it. I could imagine that being the interim deal.
I agree with you, Luke, but the problem here is that the 11th hour is kind of now because we have to extend the transition period. Otherwise, if we're going for this tactic of driving the car until the cliff, that means October this year. And then we run into a lot of legal obstacles when you want to extend the transition period in a whatever kind of way. And that would need a lot of political goodwill on the European side. And I don't see the UK government quite now building up this kind of political goodwill. It's just a lot of posing and threatening to run away, writing weird letters to each other. And if that's the idea of a Tory negotiation of a kind of substantial deal in the end, I don't think it would work out.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you could get a classic diplomatic miscalculation in that sense arising from Brexit. They don't understand the diplomatic position of the rest of the EU states and the difficulties that that kind of psychological element presents to doing a deal. And that is a kind of scenario where you could have an accidental no trade deal January 2021.
Yeah, they're certainly playing a very odd game of hardball and seem confident that they're going to win it at this point, which nobody else seems to think is the correct analysis. So the deal that you're suggesting, the EU has been quite adamant that you can't split the four freedoms of single market membership. So freedom of movement of people, and freedom of movement of goods are two of those freedoms. And so I'm not convinced that the EU would agree to the UK basically staying in the single market for goods and not for people. Although in some ways the Chequers agreement sort of did hint towards something like that. There's lots of constraints on what the EU can agree to that I don't think are well understood by the UK government or people in the UK necessarily. We've all been on a learning curve about how the EU works because, you know, traditionally it's not something that we've learned a lot about from the media. And I think that there's a lot of constraints and the EU isn't going to be able to bend as much as possibly the UK government thinks they're going to. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens when we really get to the cliff edge, as Christos says. But I think there's a lot of potential for this to end not very well unless, you know, they really do some considerable changing tack pretty soon.
So Laura, could you give us an account of what a typical trade deal looks like? Because we often have a perception of it as a vehicle for corporate power grab and the loss of democratic control. But also, you know, certainly Nick Dearden from Global Justice Now has described quite a lot of democratic input, certainly from the EU bloc. What would it look like if Canada and the EU would start negotiating again from scratch?
Trade deals are really about enabling more trade to happen. That's fine to a degree, but as time's gone on, trade deals have come not just to cover tariffs on goods, which is what they traditionally were for, and about reducing tariffs on goods, but they're really starting to creep into spaces in our society where you wouldn't expect to be affected by trade deals. So, for instance, we've heard a lot about the National Health Service and how that could be impacted by a trade deal with the US. Now, obviously, we're not actually thinking of selling the NHS to the United States. That's not what trade deals do. But the reason why trade deals impact on that is because they've started to make rules about how national governments regulate various parts of their society and how they run services. So, for instance, it can have an impact on whether NHS services are privatised and whether they stay privatised or not. So as these trade deals start to impact on more and more areas, not just importing and exporting businesses, it becomes a problem that their priority is just do more trade, because that's not really what we want to be thinking about when we're thinking, how should we run the NHS? That's not our priority. Our priority is about giving decent healthcare. And we've got lots of other priorities in society, like to preserve a decent environment and to make sure that workers get a fair wage. So to have a binding international law, and that's what a trade deal is, that's focused on a single objective, to do more trade, but reaches into all of these areas, then kind of puts trade on a pedestal and makes it a priority above all these other important objectives like health and workers and environment and so on.
Standing behind that as well is this idea of Brexit as this kind of strangeness of Brexit compared to most deals, whereas most trade deals are trying to turn like the small amount of trade into a slightly larger amount of trade that two countries or two blocs do with one another. As you say, with this deal, there's already an absolute mountain of trade, and it's probably the first political project in the neoliberal era that's actively sought to increase barriers to trade between Britain and its biggest trading partner, the EU. So it's quite a strange beast, but it has had this positive effect from your description of forcing the EU into thinking differently about its trade deals in general. The trade justice movement has developed its own plan for a deal, like the status quo neoliberals generally, I think it's fair to say, probably don't like the trade justice movement plan. I think someone online has described it as an anti-trade trade deal. But you, Christos, were, when you read it, you were quite taken with it. Traditionally in the German SPD, I would say, and please do correct me, it was quite a pro-TTIP part of the European socialist family. It was quite keen on TTIP, pushed that quite a bit in the European Parliament. Do you see that there's a potential with these ideas and with the kind of new circumstance that Brexit creates that we've described to maybe push the European centre-left towards a different way of thinking about trade and regulation?
Yeah, I think so. Let me start with correcting you on the SPD position. You're quite right, they were pushing for TTIP, but that was a different time. It was a different leadership and probably also kind of different membership still. And I don't think that a majority of the SPD today would push for such a kind of trade deal, not only because the times have changed. And it's that why I like the idea of the trade justice movement so much, because Laura just said the traditional trade deal put trade on a pedestal and everything else was kind of in the second row. But in this trade proposal, the public interest comes first. And what Corona has shown us is that the public interest is something far broader and with far more direct impact on our personal lives. So when we talk about health services in a trade deal, it's not that far away anymore. We have experienced how important that is. And putting that into the center of a common deal between the European Union and the United Kingdom, I think could also make an example of what can be achieved when we interpret international law in a progressive manner.
And Laura, what's your plan then? How do we turn on its head the traditional conception of the trade deal that's quite influenced by what you might call market fundamentalism? How do we really push back and, as Christos says, promote the public interest?
I think people, first of all, need to understand what trade deals are like traditionally, and then to think outside the box of what do we really want in terms of a trade deal. And that's what we were doing in developing this alternative model deal for the EU-UK relationship. I mean, it really isn't anti-trade. It actually would be much more effective at keeping a free trade in goods going between the EU and the UK, as long as those goods are produced to high standards. But, you know, trade has benefits. And so we were like, we wanted to look at, you know, how can we actually harness the benefits of trade where it's useful, but how can we make sure that trade legislation isn't used as a way of pushing down regulations and standards that ultimately are about giving us a better life? And that's really what we've tried to do with this deal. So I think you ask, you know, how can we push this forward? I think, first of all, we need to open people's eyes to what is possible. There's no reason why international bilateral deals have to be about free trade. They could be about securing minimum standards, for instance. There's no reason why we should be negotiating with other countries to remove trade barriers when, in fact, we could be saying, right, how about we both agree that, you know, our workers' rights will never dip below this level? And that's a good basis for our cooperation. So I think, you know, we need to broaden our mind about what's possible. And then we just need to push for it in every possible forum.
The thinking there is that we've got this completely unprecedented moment in trade deal history where the UK wants to make trade more full of friction rather than frictionless. And you're sort of thinking around that into, okay, if we're going to have more friction, why not make it good friction? I'm just really struggling to imagine how you reshape the narrative when the actual government is kind of bonfire of red tape government.
Yeah, I mean, it's always difficult to persuade a government that doesn't really believe in the value of regulation that they should do so. But to think of governments more broadly, and especially governments that are accountable to parliaments for their trade regulations, which is not the case in the UK. You know, parliament has very little say over what goes into trade deals, and therefore the people have very little say. But in some countries, you know, the people have quite a lot of say in what goes into trade deals. And often people would like international protection for their rights and for standards that they value. That's why we have a lot of international deals. People ultimately understand that the government they've got now, which might perhaps is a good government, is not the government they're going to have in 5 or 10 years' time, who might not be such a good government. And a lot of people see the benefit in sort of binding future governments' hands, where possible, to good things. And so I think that's why we would be motivated to do this. And I think, you know, especially governments that are accountable to parliaments, that are accountable to people, that's how they would agree to such a thing.
And so would a reasonable summary of this plan that we've all been discussing, like, be democracy before capitalism? Or, you know, at least some way, how do we use democracy to render the capitalism we have much more progressive? So are there positives in linking this back to coronavirus and the post-COVID-19 world that, as Christos was saying earlier, raises these huge challenges for democratic societies, but also creates a different sense potentially of what our preferences are, demonstrates the power that government has and the things that government can do when it really feels that it has to do them, like it did in the context of this pandemic, but it arguably also does in relation to climate change and a range of other things.
What we've tried to do in this model trade deal is develop a deal that puts people and the public interest first, as Christos said, and relegates trade and the priorities of private businesses who do trade lower down the list of interests. And I think it's about public over private. It's about people versus big power. You know, those dynamics are very real, and we are trying to flip it round to make sure that it's really people in the public interest who get prioritised in international treaty making, and specifically in the EU-UK case.
Yeah, and in contrast with the government's ideas, this trade proposal would accept that we're interdependent. And this is also something we learned in the COVID crisis. We're interdependent when we're talking about PPE, when we're talking about vaccines and inhalators and things like that. So there is a lot of interdependence between the European Union and the United Kingdom. And acknowledging that and setting common standards would be also kind of calling the bluff of this government, because when you don't read the small print, you could believe that it's a competition between the European Union and Norway who has the higher standards. On the one hand, the European Union wants to uphold the standards. It's about the regulatory alignment. But on the other hand, if you hear the Prime Minister, it's about if we're diverging from these standards, it's upwards. So let's call the bluff and put on the table this kind of regulatory agreement where the standards are written down.
That's a great idea.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. This podcast was a collaboration with the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung. For more information on their work on building progressive dialogues between Germany and Britain, go to fes-london.org. If you want to know how the discussion ends, you can, as usual, access additional material by joining the Another Europe is Possible campaign. Members of Another Europe help keep the show on the road, even in these difficult times. To join, go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's Extra Time, we talk about the hidden role of Donald Trump in these negotiations. He's reached a new low in his response to the anti-racist uprising we've seen in the United States. We'll be back very soon. See you then, and of course, look after each other. You're now moving into members-only material. Thanks so much for supporting the campaign. It really does make a huge difference in these tough times. So look, Donald Trump in some ways is the elephant in the room in these trade talks. Surely it's not really viable for Britain to do a trade deal with a hardline economic nationalist who believes every trade deal that America has ever signed has been a conspiracy against the United States. Or at least you would think that, but Britain seems quite keen on this American trade deal. And doesn't that affect the kind of trade deal that Britain wants to strike with the EU? Because if it turns around to Donald Trump and Boris Johnson says, hey, we'll give you the deal of the century, it's going to be fantastic, you know, you're going to love it, and you can flood our market with all your chlorinated chicken and other such things, all of those goods could potentially find their way via a trade deal with the EU into the European market. So this negotiation is presumably having to take into account all of these other negotiations that the UK is doing at the same time. And that maybe also accounts for some of the craziness of the UK government position, right? That you don't quite know where you are from one day to the next around what Britain actually wants.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to try and do these two negotiations at the same time. And fundamentally, there hasn't been any sort of honest and public decision making made about which path we're really going to take. I think the UK government has tried to present it as, you know, that the UK can go its own way. But when you're talking about international trade and, you know, as you've said, the world is so interconnected, there's not really any such thing as going your own way. And there's really two, possibly three main leaders on kind of how these things are done. There's the sort of US approach to regulation, because really trade deals are really very much about regulation these days and about regulation and standards. There's the US approach, there's the European approach, and then China, you know, is often has a slightly different way of doing things. And these are the three kind of superpowers in this arena. And so ultimately, we can't get a trade deal that works well for the UK-EU situation and also answers what the US want from us in a trade deal. It's not really possible. And we haven't made clearly a public decision about which we're going to do. It certainly seems at the moment, if the rhetoric is to be believed and the proposals that are on the table, that we're leaning towards, you know, the US way of doing things, which, you know, is risky in so many ways, not least because we're negotiating with Donald Trump, essentially, but also because the way that the US regulates industries is just a lot less stringent. And a lot of the things that we hold dear in this country, like high animal welfare standards, you know, like a public NHS and many other standards, just are not prioritised and are not protected and sometimes are actively eroded by what can go in a trade deal. So, you know, yeah, it's a real worry and it does seem a strange strategy to negotiate with the US at this time.
I don't know if you saw what Penny Mordaunt's answer was in the Commons today when somebody was asking her about chlorinated chicken, which seems to be the thing which has grabbed everybody's imagination. And her answer was the British consumer will vote with its feet, basically. And I'm sure what they'll want is high quality, fair priced food with an accent on animal welfare or however she phrased it. But she seemed to be saying regulations are over. Now it's in the hands of the shopper. Do you think that's just bravado or is that serious government policy? Could it be serious government policy?
I think that, as you say, it's a way of getting out of needing to do regulation. It's saying to people, you know, you make these decisions, you make these choices. But it's going to be very difficult for people on low incomes to choose that sort of thing on a day-to-day basis. You know, if there's one chicken and another chicken, and most people don't have time to read extensive tracts about animal welfare regulation. One of the reasons we have government at all is to set minimums. It's for us to make decisions as a society as a whole and decide what we believe in and what's right, and then to enact that in policy. And that's what we're looking to the government to do. And then they're batting it back to us as individuals to say, we're not going to bother doing that job, even though that's kind of what a government is for. You know, we'll leave that to you. And yeah, you know, personally, I don't think that's a particularly good approach.
I'm afraid, to be honest, that this is not only bravado, it's the idea of this government on how to do politics. The idea of autonomy, of sovereignty applied to the customer in this case. And on the other hand, they have to offer something to Donald Trump and the United States because, as Laura correctly said, you either do the US way, the Chinese way, or the European way. And since this government seems to be inclined not to do the European way, that seems to be the main driving force behind this, they need to do it some other way because despite the idea of global Britain, the UK is not big enough to set its own regulatory standards.
To link back to what you said right at the beginning, Laura, around the strange absence of a coalition in society for the government's policy, you also see that in relation to the US stuff too, right? So you now have the very peculiar sight of the Daily Mail running a really enthusiastic and energetic campaign against the onset of an American trade deal and its threat to UK farming and all of this stuff, presumably reflecting the demands and interests of their readership, which I'd imagine quite a few farmers read the Daily Mail. I don't know why I think that, pure assumption, but you can see it being true. And yeah, it is difficult to make sense sometimes of what this government is doing. And I think part of the reason for that is the secrecy around which they do government decision making in general, right? So if you saw the deal, the 11th hour deal that was done that got us the withdrawal agreement, it's completely hush hush with three or four people right at the top until it happens. So they're sort of leaving the whole of society and all of their stakeholders, including a, you know, pro-Brexit newspaper and others, sort of at tenterhooks on what actually is going to happen. And then at some point they'll pull a rabbit out of a hat and there will be something, and we'll just have to see what it's like.
It's a lot easier for the government if they can just whip something out at the end and it's a fait accompli and there's nothing we can do about it at that point, or very little we can do about it at that point. I think that would suit them very well. It's interesting that, you know, what you say about the Daily Mail and its potential readership, because you do have to wonder who would really benefit from a policy that allows in, you know, low welfare meat or even lower welfare meat, because, you know, let's not fool ourselves, you know, not all chickens are treated well in the UK either. You know, it's kind of another level of regulation in the US that's even more problematic. You know, it's certainly not good for British farming and British food production. And I think, you know, with the pandemic, we've seen reasons why we might want to preserve some industries nationally rather than just completely rely on foreign suppliers for everything. Because, you know, it's clear that when push comes to shove in a real crisis, people are going to clamp down and keep their supplies in their own countries, quite understandably. And so, you know, with real essentials like food and, you know, medical supplies like PPE, you know, you probably do want to maintain some domestic production. So that's for everybody's well-being. And so traditionally, sometimes right-wing constituencies, like farmers or some farmers, this isn't good for them. It's not really good for consumers. People don't feel good about eating low welfare produce. It also brings higher rates of certain illnesses because ultimately the practices that are covered up by chlorination are less good on a public health front. They don't do such a good job at controlling germs throughout the production line. So, you know, it's not really good for anybody. And certainly nobody in the UK is demanding it. No one is saying, like, let's lower our welfare standards so that chickens cost 10p less than they currently do. Because we're probably not talking about huge drops in prices at the checkout either, you know, by the time supermarkets have taken their cuts and so on. You've got to ask who's really driving this kind of policy. And it doesn't feel like it's coming from people in any way, really.
Yeah. And in that sense, the electoral coalition that gave us Brexit in the first place is really quite a peculiar beast, because at the top, you obviously have these ideologically committed, very economic, libertarian, deregulatory groups that, you know, what's their social basis in the UK? What, a few hedge funds or something? I mean, you're sort of grasping around businesses, civil society. It's hard to find. And in the electorate, most Brexit voters don't want this deregulatory agenda either. So you're left thinking, well, look, that if this comes off, it's been a very clever way of getting a country that is not inclined to this deregulatory agenda at all to accede to it on grounds of national sovereignty and political nationalism, even though it's not really what anyone, if you ask them, would go for.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Luke. And I think part of the negotiations we're seeing right now is also because the EU is so afraid of something similar happening to other countries as well. It's a toxic cocktail that has been applied to the United Kingdom. And they're afraid that something similar will be happening in another country, and furthermore undermining the ability of the European Union to set standards, to uphold some kind of regulatory standards. And to be frank, they're not that high. They just seem right now to be good because the UK is searching something so much lower in the interest of very, very few people.
Oh, well, we'll see what happens.
I'm genuinely petrified about it, I have to admit. I normally take this stuff with equanimity, but considering that there's absolutely no British potential for a parliamentary response, I can't see a way out.
Well, the way out is we're left relying on the persuasive faculties and campaigning capacities of the Daily Mail and others on the right, I think, on this question.
And Laura Bannister and our European friend.
Yeah, of course. That too. But I mean, in terms of the people who this government will really listen to, I think it might be some of those people on the right.
I think the problem is that we rely on the abilities of Johnson to do a U-turn in the end, because he can sell something as a success. It's awful. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you both so much for coming on, and we'll be in touch.